Cha-ching. That's the sound of Lowe's Labor Day savings. Get up to 45% off select major appliances and save up to an additional $100 on select laundry pairs. Plus, get 3 bags of Miracle-Gro 0.75 cubic foot garden soil for just $10. Labor Day deals are on now at Lowe's, in-store and online. Valid through 9/9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. See Lowe's.com for more details. Soil offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
By law, 21 plus, terms and conditions apply.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. In today's episode, I'm going to be doing something I've done a few times. I don't do it very often. So first and foremost, if this episode ends up sounding really good, huge shout out to Erica, because these episodes are incredibly difficult for her to edit. The reason for that is, as I mentioned on last week's follow-up, I've been doing a ton of research trying to separate fact from fiction in the Delphi case and in the evidence that's been presented. We've heard from Bob Mata, Andrea Burkhart, and Michael Osbrook, who are all attorneys, who talked to us about how they viewed the evidence that was presented at trial and how that led them to the conclusion that Richard Allen is innocent. Over the last couple of weeks, we had on Kevin and Anya from the Murder Sheet podcast, who also attended the trial. Kevin is also an attorney, and they talked about how the evidence they saw at trial, which was the same evidence, how it led them to believe that Richard Allen is in fact guilty. In hearing from all of these people, what's occurred to me is everybody, I don't want to use the word spin, that has a negative connotation to it, but everybody views the evidence through a lens, I think, once they have come to their conclusion. So I'm not saying that any of these people went into the trial, went into looking at the evidence with a foregone conclusion and warp things in their mind that way. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that as they viewed the evidence, they used that, using themselves as being the finders of fact, to come up with a conclusion. But once they've come up with the conclusion, and I'm not even talking about those four guests specifically, just people in general, once they've analyzed the evidence or the data and used that data to establish a conclusion, after that, when they're talking about it, like on a podcast, for example, people tend to speak about the evidence in a way that supports their conclusion. And again, I'm kind of tiptoeing around here because I don't want this to come off as sounding negative or accusing anyone of bias. Lord knows I get accused of that constantly. It's just a perspective thing. So what I wanted to do, now that trial transcripts are available, where you can go actually read them, I wanted to go through and create a couple of episodes about the case that are fact only, exactly what was said at the trial, what evidence was presented for the three legs of the state's case, as Kevin and Anya had put it. Those three legs were, first, the timeline. That's what we spent the most amount of time talking about. That was the witnesses at the trail compared to Richard Allen's own statements. Also, the firearms evidence and the testimony about that. And then lastly, the confessions, where we got into a lot of Dr. Monica Walla, who plays a big part in the confession piece of this, because the confession that actually had a narrative came through her. So, and then there's a few other kind of housekeeping things, just evidence that I want to talk about at the end of all this. So what I'm going to be doing today, and over at least I'm thinking this week and next week, possibly 3 weeks, depends on how long it takes me to get through this. These types of episodes are very difficult for me to plan out. because I don't have a script in front of me. What I have in front of me is an 18-page document of notes that came from my own chicken scratch and my whiteboard drawings that looked like an insane mind map in my office over the last couple of weeks. I try to organize them into notes that I can follow along with, but I did not write them into a script. Part of the reason for that is that when I write them into a script, I tend to start putting in my own analysis when I'm writing. That's just the way that I write. That's part of the way that I investigate. The writing process is part of how I investigate something. What you're going to hear today is zero analysis. That's my goal. Hopefully, I'll be able to keep my own self in check as I'm going along here. But I wrote this outline, or I wrote these notes in a way that I can present you bullet-pointed facts without giving you any analysis. I don't want to sway your opinion whatsoever throughout this process. What I want is just to give you the facts and let you draw your own conclusion. We have plenty of opinions to work from. We have the four guests that I just talked about. Myself and Janet and Zach have talked about this case ad nauseum. These are just the actual facts. And again, I would encourage anybody to go online. If you just Google the Delphi transcripts, you can actually access them and read the entire transcripts for yourself. So, and again, like I said, I don't know exactly what this is going to look like. When I started making these notes, I wrote this outline out for this to be one episode with three acts covering those three things. But I feel like it's probably going to be broken up instead into two or three episodes. I have a hunch that today's episode, I'll only get through the timeline stuff. I'll be kind of watching the clock as I'm recording. If I finish the timeline stuff and there's plenty of time, I'll move on to the next section. If we're, you know, around that 30 to 40 minute mark, we'll cut off this episode and then I'll pick back up tomorrow because I don't want to overwhelm you with a whole bunch of information. And this timeline stuff can get confusing. There's really not a whole lot there. There's only four witnesses that we're dealing with, but I'm trying to lay it out in a way so we know exactly, or as close as we can know to exactly the times when these witnesses saw people or saw Bridge Guy. They all believe they saw Bridge Guy. And if the evidence indicates that Bridge Guy is in fact Richard Allen. So the first thing that I want to say is there's a distinction that needs to be made there, a couple of them. First of all, when you hear me talk about the Freedom Bridge, I want you guys to know, and I've mentioned this in the follow-up, most of you know this, not everyone does. There are two bridges on those trails. The Monon High Bridge is the bridge where we see the picture of Bridge Guy. That's the bridge Abby and Libby crossed right before they took the video that we all saw, that like 45-second video. That's the Monon High Bridge. That's, you know, we can call that kind of the crime scene, right? Then there is the Freedom Bridge, which is at the other end of the trail. So after you leave the Monon High Bridge, you walk down the trail, you go into a wooded area. After you leave the wooded area, then you come to the Freedom Bridge, which is towards the entrance to the trail system. So they're in opposite ends. So remember, two bridges. The Freedom Bridge is at the beginning of the trail. The Monon High Bridge is where the crime scene is. So that's thing one. Thing two, pay attention as we are going through these witness statements to who these witnesses are identifying. I'm sure a lot of you guys, again, know this, but I'll just tell you up front. Do not conflate any of these witnesses in their descriptions as them saying that they recognized Richard Allen or identified Richard Allen. None of them did. Who they all identified and what's being questioned at trial is, did they identify who we know as Bridge Guy, more specifically, the person that they saw in the image that was released to the public, the person that was taken from the screen grab from Libby's video? So they're being questioned about whether the person they saw is Bridge Guy. They are not being questioned about whether the person they saw is Richard Allen. So just don't conflate those two things. Now, with that being said, I'm going to start moving through these. Kind of the format I have this laid out in is first I do like a timeline kind of at a glance to try to give you guys a basic idea. I don't know how helpful that will be, but hopefully it will be sort of helpful for you. Just kind of the basic bullet points of when people saw who they think was Bridge Guy. And then I'm going to go through the witnesses one at a time. One is Riley Ann Voorhees, who was traveling with Breanne Wilbur and two other small girls. So Wilbur and Voorhees were in the group of four that we've talked about in the past. After that, we're going to move into Betsy Blair's testimony. And then we're going to move into Sarah Carbaugh's testimony. She's the one that was driving down the road and said she saw the muddy and or bloody man walking down the road around 4 o'clock that afternoon. So that's it. There's those four witnesses. And everything that I'm going to be going over is based on the trial transcripts. We'll be talking about prior statements to police. I just want you guys to understand that when I'm talking about that, I'm referencing discussion or testimony about the prior statements at trial from the trial transcripts. So a lot of times this comes in as impeachment evidence during cross-examination. I'm not going to get into, you know, volume and page numbers for everything just to muddy the things up. But just so you know, if it says in her prior statement, she said XYZ, I'm not looking at the actual prior police statement. I'm looking at the trial transcript where she was confronted with that statement, just to make that clear. So for each witness, I'm going to talk about the route they described, the time they believe it happened, what the interaction was like with the alleged bridge guy, and then their description of that person at trial. And then I'm going to circle back to their earlier statements that were discussed at trial, most of which were used sort of as like impeachment evidence. And then I have a section under each one that I have labeled just as changes and limits. And so that's where we can identify there was a distinct difference between something they said in a prior statement compared to what they said at trial. And by limits, that's where I'm going to be kind of making points that we can't jump to conclusions somewhere, right? So that maybe there's a time that is an estimate, but you know that's limited by XYZ, whatever that thing is. So that's my plan moving forward. And I can see that I'm already 10 minutes in. So this will be about the timeline. I can tell you now, this episode is going to be the timeline episode, which I think is good. I think this way we can, like we normally do in our investigative long form episodes on Truth and Justice, we try to focus on one thing at a time. So that's what we're going to do now. Without any further yapping by me about what I'm going to do, I'm just going to go ahead and start doing it.
Hey, this is Kevin.
This is Joe.
And Nick Jonas from Hey Jonas. This episode of Hey Jonas is brought to you by the all-new drink lineup at McDonald's.
I don't have to tell you that there are already so many great drink options at McDonald's, mm-hmm. but the new drink lineup, I mean, it takes things to another level.
They've got delicious caffeinated refreshers like the Strawberry Watermelon Refresher, crafted sodas like the Sprite Berry Blast, and now the all-new Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer.
We're talking about a total game changer. It's made with Red Bull. It's mixed with blue raspberry flavor and topped with freeze-dried dragon fruit.
Wow.
McDonald's has given us a refreshing new boost for your day.
And the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer is arriving just as you're heading back to the dorms for the fall semester. It's got a boost of energy and a kick of flavor when you need it the most. You know, powering through those lectures and studying sessions, you're going to need it. Kicking the afternoon slump or rallying for the weekend.
Try one of the many new drinks like the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer, also available with Red Bull Zero, now at McDonald's.
Football is back, and something big is coming. That's right. September 2nd, DraftKings Game Day arrives, and that is what you need. Game Day at DraftKings will be where it's at. And don't forget, we are now live in all 50 states. That's right, 50. One app, every sport, all 50 states. And new DraftKings customers, now you can sign up with code KSR and spend $5 and get $200 in rewards within 21 days. It includes all markets. That's right, all markets. That code is KSR in partnership with DraftKings. The crown is yours. And you can bet with DK Sportsbook.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 18 and over, Kentucky only. Eligibility and restrictions apply. $50 in non-withdrawable bonus bets issued every 7 days via click to claim for 21 days. Bonus bets expire 7 days after issuance. For additional terms and responsible gaming resources, see sportsbook.draftkings.com/promos. Limited time offer.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Okay, so first and foremost, let's go over a basic timeline at a glance. In this, I'm going to be giving you the times that the witnesses said they had encounters, as well as known times we have about Abby and Libby's movements, just so you can kind of get the relevance of all of that. So first and foremost, we have 12:25 p.m., so this is before Abby and Libby are even at the trail. Brianne Wilbur has a time-stamped photo that places her group, that's the group of the four girls, at the Freedom Bridge. So that's kind of the entrance end of the trail system. So that's 12:25 p.m. Then at 12:43 p.m., she has another timestamp photo that showed the Monanhai Bridge. So in that 18 minutes between those two photos, they are first at 12:25, the other end at the Freedom Bridge. And then at 12:43, she takes a photo that shows the Monanhai Bridge. So they've reached the crime scene bridge at that point. At this point, Abby and Libby are still not on the trails. At 1:26 p.m., she takes another photograph on a bench while her whole group was returning towards Freedom Bridge. So this is, they started at Freedom Bridge. They went all the way to Monanhai Bridge. There's a photo at the beginning, a photo when they got to Monanhai Bridge. Then they're returning back to the beginning. And at 1:26 p.m., she takes the photo on the bench on the way back to the Freedom Bridge. She says that she saw the man after this photo and before she left the wooded trail. So time-wise, at 1:26, Abby and Libby are still not there. They are still not at the park at all. They have already came, went to the Monanhai Bridge, and they're on their way back when they took the picture at 1:26. After that and towards the Freedom Bridge is when they encountered who they believe is Bridge Guy. Now, fitting into this, at 1:49 p.m., so 23 minutes after that photo was taken, that's when Abby and Libby are dropped off at the trail. Then we move up to 2:05 p.m., and that's when cell phone data puts Abby and Libby towards or near the Monanhai Bridge, the crime scene bridge. So in that kind of 15-minute time span between about 10 to 2 and 2:05 is when Abby and Libby got dropped off and they walked their way all the way to the bridge. Now, as we move forward in the timeline, at about 2:15 p.m., that's when Riley Voorhees, who's traveling with Brianne Wilbur, she estimates that they had an encounter with who they believe was Bridge Guy near the end of the trail, back near Freedom Bridge. So on the opposite end of the trail from the crime scene. So that's an important time that 2:15, she says she sees who she believes is Bridge Guy all the way back at the other end of the trail. However, and we'll get into this more in a minute, there's a caveat there. That time, that 2:15 p.m. time is an estimate. She testified that she reached Wilbur's house at about 2:20 and she had to be home by 2:30. So based on that, because they had walked to the trail from Wilbur's house, I believe. So she estimates that the time they saw who she believes was Bridge Guy was at about 2:15 p.m. And again, remember, Wilbur had said that we know that she took the picture at 1:26. And she said that they saw who they believed to be Bridge Guy sometime after that. Now let's kind of jump back to that same kind of time period. We have between 1:45 and 2:15 p.m. comes in Betsy Blair. Betsy Blair had walked the loop a couple of times that day. This was her third time. And based on her Fitbit data, between 1:45 p.m. and 2:15 p.m., that 30-minute period is when she was on the trail. So about 15 minutes to the Monanhai Bridge and then about 15 minutes back. So the time she was on the trail was that 30-minute span from 1:45 to 2:15. That's confirmed by the surveillance video at the Hoosier Harvest store. So we can be pretty confident of that. She says that she saw who she believes was Bridge Guy standing out on the bridge at that time, somewhere in that span. If we kind of cut it in half, say she got to the bridge at the end of it, that would be at probably right around 2:00 p.m. So, we'll get into how all that fits together. And then we have at 3:56 p.m., which we confirmed through surveillance video, is when Sarah Carbaugh, driving her red Saturn, was traveling eastbound And that's when she says that she saw the muddy and bloody man walking down the road. So that's everything at a glance from 2:25 p.m. to about 4 p.m. Now, I know that's a lot, and I'm sure a lot of you are already trying to like draw this out. It does get confusing because there's overlapping times. We have the one estimate time in there at 2:15, and then we have Betsy Blair that we only have a 30-minute window in there. But, you know, I'll circle back to this after we go through all of the different witnesses because I'm already much longer than I meant to be. I haven't even got into the witnesses yet. So the first witness, remember, this is one of the group of four girls. This is Riley Ann Voorhees, and she was traveling with Breanne Wilbur and the two younger girls. So from Riley's testimony, the route, she said that Voorhees, Wilbur, and two younger girls walked from town over Freedom Bridge to the High Bridge and then returned. She said that near the Freedom Bridge end, while still in the trees, she saw a man walking towards the High Bridge while the girls were walking towards town. She estimates that that encounter happened about 2:15 p.m., as I mentioned, because she reached Wilbur's house at about 2:20 and had to be home by 2:30. That's all from the trial transcript. Now, the interaction. She says that she said hello to the man, that he did not respond. He glared at them and appeared unhappy, and his hands remained in his pocket throughout the encounter. So it's a very, you know, they're passing each other. He's walking towards the Monon High Bridge. They're walking the other way. She says she said hello to him, didn't respond, gave her a look, kept walking, hands in pockets. Now, her description of that man at trial for the clothing, she said that he was overdressed for the weather. He was wearing darker clothing, a heavy coat, a hood, and a hat, and had a running mask type covering over the nose and mouth. Now, as far as the person, she describes him as a white man. She says larger, or quote from the transcript, bigger build than clearly muscular. So more larger or bigger, not necessarily muscular. And she said that the man was taller than her, and she is 5'7". She testified 5'10", quote, could be accurate. She did not see the full face. Now, I think the height is going to be a big thing for anyone's analysis in this. So for me, all I'm looking at is not necessarily if she thought he was tall, if she thought he was short, if she thought he was 5'10". The thing that is something that I would anchor in is the fact that she says she herself is 5'7", and she believes the man was taller than her. She did testify that after she saw the picture of Bridge Guy, she said she was sure that that was the man she had passed. So her identification of Bridge Guy seems relatively solid. She gave a statement to police about who she saw, what he looked like. Then she saw the image and she said, yep, that's the guy. That's the guy she saw. Now, at trial, some of her earlier statements were discussed. Her first statement was from February 15th. Then she told investigator Stephen Mullen that the man was wearing all black, black jeans, black hoodie, black boots, and a black face covering, that he also wore a hat, kept his hands in his pocket, and appeared to be in his 20s or 30s and had a bigger build. Her map from trial placed the encounter near the Freedom Bridge at around 2:15 p.m. Again, this is one of those limits, and I'll keep saying this. I don't think we can put a whole lot of weight on 2:15 p.m. because she says that's an estimate without an anchor, other than the time that she got back to her friend's house and when she had to be home. 2 days later, she gave another statement. And again, this is what was discussed at trial about her previous statement. In that the statement on the 17th of February, she acknowledged descriptions of a muscular build. She said dirty blonde hair visible outside of the hoodie, brown eyes, a wrinkly face, and a square jaw. During her testimony, a transcript from that previous interview was shown to her where she said in that previous interview, in this interview here, that she said the hair was, quote, like curly. Now, the judge stopped that attempt at impeachment, but she did agree that the statement reflected what she believed at the time. So in the testimony, she said, yes, at the time on February 17th, she believed that the man had, quote, like curly hair. So changes in limits. There's the color difference. Her initial description was all black clothing, and that differs from the blue jacket, blue jeans appearance in the released image. But she explained that the man's unhappy demeanor may have registered to her as dark clothing. That just is what it is. We all know eyewitness identification. You know, that's all I'll say about that. It's not particularly accurate. But when she saw the image, at that point, she was sure that was the guy. So whether, you know, it's up to you whether you think it's important that she, whether she noted in that brief encounter when she didn't know anything was wrong, what exactly color the clothing was. And then when she saw the image, then she said that's the guy and happened to be wearing a blue jacket. And she says, it should be noted, there was a memory influence. She agreed that the later images affected her memory and that media imagery could influence her description. But she did maintain that the image showed the man that she passed. She was sure of that. Visibility is also another interesting thing to think about, because she said only the area from roughly mid-nose to the forehead was visible between the face covering and the headwear, which makes some earlier facial detail descriptions difficult to reconcile, really, because she herself on the stand even questioned how she could have described a square jaw when he was wearing a face covering over his jaw. So that's everything for Voorhees. And so now we're going to move on to Breanne Wilbur. So remember, Breanne is walking with Voorhees. She's part of that group. Now for her, here's the route, and she has some brackets. We have some solid anchors here for her statements. So we know that her group was down at the Monanhigh Bridge, the crime scene bridge, at 12:43 p.m. because she took a photo and it's timestamped. So that at 12:43, they were at the bridge. And then she took the bench photo on the return trip at 1:26 p.m. So that's after she went to the crime scene bridge. They were on their way back. Talked about this earlier. 1:26 p.m. She took another photo. And then they encountered the man after that photo, but before leaving the wooded trail. So we know that the encounter happened sometime after 1:26 p.m. Voorhees estimated the time that they saw the man at 2:15. We don't know that it was 2:15, but we do know that it was after 1:26 p.m. She said that he was walking towards the Monanhigh Bridge while they were walking back in the other direction towards town. Her description of the interaction was very similar to Voorhees, almost identical. She described the man as walking with a purpose. He did not stop or respond when Voorhees said hello, and he gave Wilbur what she called weird vibes. That's a quote. Now let's look at her descriptions again. Some of the, like this first one I'm going to give you is what she gave that same evening, the description of the man she saw that same evening, the evening that the girls went missing. But it is not from that report. This is what was discussed at trial about that report. So she testified that she told police that the man may have had something covering his nose or mouth, which is consistent with Voorhees. His head was tucked down. She could not see much hair or determine whether he had a hood or a hat. And he wore a blue or black jacket with blue pants, which all lines up pretty well with what we know as Bridge Guy. Now, build and height. At trial, she was unsure whether he was muscular. An earlier height description she gave in a police report was that she came to approximately the man's upper forearm. She characterized him as taller, but did emphasize that it was a quick pass. But again, those are one of those anchors we look for in height. If somebody says, oh, I think they were about 5'10", well, how do you know? But when someone says, I walked by him and, you know, my head was at his arm, he was significantly taller than me, that's worth noting. And again, as far as when she saw the Bridge Guy image, when she later saw the released image, her immediate thought was that it showed the person that the group had passed. She said no other person that she saw that day resembled that image other than the man that they passed on their way back to the Freedom Bridge. The section I have here is marked later statements and differences. In August of 2020, she was interviewed by the U.S. Marshals. After reviewing the statement on stand, she agreed that she had described the man as muscular, possibly in his early 30s, wearing a zip-up windbreaker in that interview, and something over his head so his hair was not visible. Now, if we go back to the description from that first evening, she allowed in that statement that it could have been a blue or a black jacket, and the trial testimony called it heavier, many-layered. The 2020 description, however, there's the big difference here, is she described it as a zip-up windbreaker. The exact time of the encounter, she did not give an exact time. And again, I just want to stress that we can't attribute Voorhees' 2:15 estimate to Wilbur. Wilbur did not say 2:15. All we know from Wilbur is that it was after 1:26 p.m. because of the timestamp on the photo, and Voorhees' time of 2:15 is just an estimate. Now, there was one little discrepancy, you know, when Kevin and Anya were on, we were talking about that there was no other group of girls, no one else saw anybody like this. There's one little thing I caught in the trial transcript, and I don't know if it was just a mistake or if it, I was just reading too much into it, but it's worth pointing out as far as the direction. So it was stated that the group did not see anyone else matching Bridge Guy's description. But on rebuttal, she said that she saw no man resembling Bridge Guy while the group was walking from the Freedom Bridge towards the High Bridge, so from the beginning of the trail to the crime scene. But the encounter they had was on the return trip. That's probably nothing. You would think it would have come out if there was anything else. I just noticed that it doesn't specify, the questioning doesn't specify if she saw anyone resembling that man, Bridge Guy, the entire time they were at the trail. The questioning was, did you see anybody resembling Bridge Guy on your way to the bridge? Could be most likely nothing, but just something worth pointing out. I had it in my notes, so you have it in your head now. You're welcome.
Hey, this is Kevin.
This is Joe.
And Nick Jonas from Hey Jonas. This episode of Hey Jonas is brought to you by the all-new drink lineup at McDonald's.
I don't have to tell you that there are already so many great drink options at McDonald's, mm-hmm. but the new drink lineup, I mean, it takes things to another level.
They've got delicious caffeinated refreshers like the Strawberry Watermelon Refresher, crafted sodas like the Sprite Berry Blast, and now the all-new Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer.
We're talking about a total game changer. It's made with Red Bull. It's mixed with blue raspberry flavor and topped with freeze-dried dragon fruit.
Wow.
McDonald's has given us a refreshing new boost for your day.
And the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer is arriving just as you're heading back to the dorms for the fall semester. It's got a boost of energy and a kick of flavor when you need it the most. You know, powering through those lectures and studying sessions, you're gonna need it. Kicking the afternoon slump or rallying for the weekend.
Try one of the many new drinks like the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer, also available with Red Bull Zero, now at McDonald's.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Okay, now we're going to move on to Betsy Blair. Before I do that, though, I just want to just kind of connect the dots a little bit with Richard Allen's statement, because that's the big thing that particularly Kevin and Anya pointed out, that if you take those statements from Wilbur and Voorhees and you compare them to Richard Allen's, they almost have to line up. What we can say is they could line up depending on what time Richard Allen got to the park. So if it was what he claims the time was in his later statement and says is what he said in the original statement, 12:30, then they likely saw someone other than him, if that's true. Because the encounter with that group happened, we know, after 1:26 p.m. as they were leaving the park and the man was walking into it. So that does not line up with him arriving at 12:30. However, if it's 1:30, which is what Doolin, the DNR officer, had written in his report, that he originally said 1:30, then it very likely could have been him, because he would have got there at 1:30. That encounter, the timing lines up for that encounter to happen. So you understand how those things fit together. And again, just to be clear, Abby and Libby are not at the park yet at this point. They don't get there until 1:49 p.m. All right, now let's move into Betsy Blair. She is not connected to those other two witnesses. Betsy Blair, she had done two earlier loops earlier that day through the trails, and then she took a break at the library, according to her testimony, and then she returned after the library to do a third loop. She parked at the Mears lot, and she walked first towards the Monon High Bridge. When she got there, she saw a man, one of the side platforms, about 50 feet away from her. Now, again, connecting dots, Richard Allen says that he had went out and stood on one of those side platforms. So what she's saying, again, as Kevin Rani pointed out, lines up with Richard Allen could have been him, depending on timing. The sequence, she says, is the man looked towards her. She turned around on her return towards the Mears entrance. She passed Libby and Abby, and then continued the rest of her loop and left. So for Betsy Blair, she's a significant witness because the person she saw on the bridge platform, if that was Bridge Guy, you know, she kind of connects everybody together because she looks out on the platform. She sees this man that she says is Bridge Guy standing on this platform. And then she turns around and starts walking back out and passes Abby and Libby walking towards the bridge. And so she bookends them, right? So she has this guy on this end. She has Abby and Libby coming from this end and nobody in between there. So almost certainly the person she sees there is the Bridge Guy that attacked them. Now the timing, she places the third loop at approximately 1:45 to 2:15 p.m. And again, that was based on her Fitbit data. That was also confirmed by the surveillance video, which showed her car eastbound at 1:46 p.m. and westbound at 2:18 p.m. So that was, you know, her car pulling in, parking at 1:46. What did she say? About 1:45. So, you know, that lines up with her then getting out shortly after 1:46, making the trip, getting back to the car about 2:15. And again, if you kind of split the time maybe in half, you're looking at somewhere around 2 o'clock. She sees this man on the bridge. She's walking back, sees Abby and Libby. And we know from their cell phone data that at 2:05 p.m., Abby and Libby are like at or near the bridge. So Betsy Blair's statement lines up perfectly with what we know for a fact about Abby and Libby based on cell phone data. They're dropped off at 1:49 p.m. She gets to the bridge. Betsy Blair gets to the bridge around 2 o'clock. She starts walking back. And we know at 2:05 p.m., that's when Abby and Libby get to the bridge on their trail. So all of that lines up. And again, I think that it also lines up that whoever she saw on that bridge is very likely the killer. Now let's get into her descriptions at trial. Her observation was that it was a white male. She did have an unobstructed view from probably 50 feet away, but only for a moment. So she had kind of a fleeting glance at this guy from 50 feet away. She testified that his posture made him appear to be like he was expecting or looking for someone. And she, like the other witnesses, when she saw the released image before her police interview, she said she immediately recognized it as the man she'd seen on the bridge. In all three of these cases, it's not like we're relying on them. You know, they saw somebody, didn't know they should be paying attention. Then they're asked to describe them, and they describe Bridge Guy to a T. In all three instances, they have a description of what they recall from what they saw. But in all three of them, when they saw the image of Bridge Guy, all three of them said, yes, that's him. That's the man I saw. So she's very convinced that that was the person she saw on the bridge. As far as age and hair in her earlier descriptions that were discussed at trial, she described the man as in his 20s or 30s with brown, poofy hair. Then in a March 7th, 2019 statement, so 2 years later, she described him as more boyish and youthful in appearance. So that's one thing to point out. There is consistency with all three of these witnesses, Wilbur Voorhees and Blair, all in their initial descriptions of the person they saw, described him as being like 20s or 30s, younger. This is the important piece, right? Is height, build, face, headwear. Now remember, she's 50 feet away glancing at him, but she said her best guess in her previous statements, in her early statements, was that the man was average height. He did not seem short. She could not see if there was facial hair or a hat. Changes in limits, hair versus a hat. When a juror asked whether the apparent brown poofy hair could have been a hat because of the distance, she said that it could have been. I mean, I in reading Betsy Blair's testimony, I will say, like, I found her to be a very, very credible witness. The way she answered, that's a perfect example. A juror asked because of the distance. You said there in the original statement, there was brown poofy hair. Maybe it was a hat. And she said, yeah, it could have been. Now, what remained consistent is Blair said her consistent point was recognition of the man in the released photo. When asked whether every descriptive detail had remained unchanged, she explained that she had been comparing two sketches and images. So she's saying, like, I'm not saying who that is. I'm telling you that the person I saw is the same person that's in the bridge in the photo. And that's it for Betsy Blair. So again, we're talking about a very, and in all three of these so far, if we combine everything together, you're talking about, you know, 20 seconds of encounter. You have Voorhees and Wilbur walking back, just quickly walking past a man saying hi. He walks past them. They're going opposite directions. The encounter's over. And then Betsy Blair walks out to the bridge, looks out, sees a man standing on the platform 50 feet away, turns around, walks back the other direction. So that's the entirety of their interactions. Now, lastly, we're going to move on to Sarah Carbaugh. Carbaugh did not see the man on the trail. She's the one that saw a person driving down when she was driving down the road. And this would have been if who she saw, if it is accurate and it was Bridge Guy, this would have been well after the murders, you know, like an hour and a half or at least an hour after the murders happened. So she says that she was driving east on County Road 300 north towards her house. After seeing a stressed out looking group at the Mears entrance, which the assumption there, the implication is there that it's Abby and Libby's family starting to look for them at that point. She then saw a man on the north side of the road walking west towards Delphi, opposite her direction of travel. So again, when we're talking about the amount of time of these encounters, the person she saw is walking one direction and she's driving the other direction. So as quick as that is when they go past. Time-wise, we know about when this happened, if it happened, because her red Saturn appeared on the Hoosier Harvest Store surveillance video at 3:56 p.m. She had, in her statements, called the trip the 4 o'clock hour. Now, distance and duration. So she says she slowed from her usual 30 to 35 miles an hour. She estimated the overall observation at no more than about 30 seconds. Personally, just doing math, I would say much shorter than that even. She was asked for the closest distance, and she said less than 50 feet. And then she said, quote, honestly, less than 3. And she reconciled her earlier testimony of more than 20 feet as the distance on approach rather than the closest pass. I don't know. This distance, I'm just pointing it out because there were differences and it was questioned at trial. I don't think it really matters. I think we can all figure this out. She was driving one direction. He was in the opposite side of the road. So you have an entire lane between you. For sure, when you're driving, as far as like the time and the distance, it wasn't what it was her driving down and he's on the side of the road on the other side of the road at, you know, she's at 30, 35 miles an hour. So however long that is, that's when she saw him. But now her description at trial, person and the demeanor, she said was a white male, roughly 30s to 40s, possibly 50s, hands in pockets. The hands in pockets thing is also consistent throughout everybody, by the way. Hands in pockets. No eye contact, slumped or curled into himself, wearing many layers for the weather. The clothing and condition, she says, was a dark coat slash top, light colored jeans, mud concentrated on the clothing and pants, red blood-like spatters on the light pants. She repeatedly characterized him at trial as being covered in mud and blood. She also testified that the released image of Bridge Guy showed the man that she saw on the road, that she is sure of that. I guess this is a bit of analysis, but I just read the transcripts. I don't doubt that Carbaugh saw something or someone. I don't know that. Well, you'll see. There's just conflict. Stories change. You guys have heard a lot of talk about this, but in her first interview, the transcript of the first interview contained the word mud 11 times and no transcribed use of the word blood. Carbaugh maintained that she had said mud and blood once in a portion where the transcription says she's mumbling. But she agreed the word blood didn't appear in the transcript. And this is the big argument with Carbaugh that people on the innocent side will point out that, you know, by trial, she's saying the guy's covered in blood, but, you know, she never said he was covered with blood in the past. It was just mud. This is how that all got shaken out at trial. In her June 19th, 2017 interview, the available transcript from that interview contained the word mud 13 times. And again, no use of the word blood. For that one, Carbaugh said there was an hour to an hour and a half video that was missing from that transcript, and she testified that she discussed mud and blood during that missing portion. And then also during that second interview, she marked a Bridge Guy photograph that was put in as an exhibit at trial, but the exhibit is from a picture from back when she did her interview back in 2019, where she had drawn on it. And she drew lines for mud on the coat and pants and dots for blood on the pants, she says, and an outline for the hat. And like I said, that marked image, if you want to see it, was admitted as State's Exhibit 221. Now, in her March 2019 interview, so she, I think I said 2019 earlier, the one I was just talking about was from a June 19th, 2017 interview. So 2 years after that, March 2019. In that transcript, that's the first time we see the word blood. That transcript contained the word blood 16 times and no mud or muddy. She compared the amount of blood to a slaughtered hog while acknowledging that she had never slaughtered a hog and was just using an analogy. But so that's just interesting I really don't know if it matters. It's up to you how much weight you put into any of this. I'll say this. I have a hard time believing she saw a stressed out group at the trail, drives a few more feet, and sees a man stumbling down the road looking like he just slaughtered a pig with blood all over him and just kept going. Maybe she did. But I also, I have a hard time believing that she saw what she describes as so much covered in blood that looked like they slaughtered a pig and told police only that he was covered in mud. And then the next interview, a couple months later, again, that he's covered in mud. She claims she might have slipped the word blood in there a couple times that are missing from the transcript, but it's very clear in those transcripts she's describing a muddy man. Maybe she's had a little bit of blood, and that morphs into 2 years later that he's completely covered with blood. No mention of mud. Now, I don't know what or why or what to make of all that. It's just a shaky statement. And also not for nothing. It really doesn't do much for whether it's Richard Allen or not Richard Allen. Because, you know, she was so far away. It was more the description of she's saying, I saw the murderer walking away is essentially what she's saying. She's not saying I saw Richard Allen walk away. Other changes in testimony, coat color. In the first interview, described the coat as tan, but she later changed the coat to blue after the second interview and after seeing the released image. At trial, she said that the first color, she said, was inaccurate because the mud made the blue coat appear brown. She also described a tan brown hoodie beneath the coat. Hair and hat, second interview described, including hair curling or poking out. At trial, she said it could have been sweaty hair or part of the hat. She admitted that repeated hat images had, quote, tainted or compromised her present ability to describe the exact hat. And so there's probably a lot of that with any of these witnesses. As time goes on and more information is released and they're talking to police more and they're showing them more pictures, I find it interesting that she's talking about curled, you know, curly hair. When we see that in the initial statements from Voorhees and Wilbur, it makes me wonder if not even like nefarious reasons, but if the investigators have these two witnesses that they saw the man and he had curly hair, you know, you would expect them to say something like, did you notice if he had curly hair or anything like that? So you could see how that could kind of slip in. Anyway, the reporting interval is another interesting thing. She first contacted police about 3 weeks after the fact at a roadblock, but then moments later, in response to a question that was phrased several months later, she agreed that that was her first initial statement. And the transcript just doesn't resolve that timing discrepancy. I don't know that that really matters, but it's just one of those things. When I'm taking notes on details, you know, I'm noting that she says, I think it was about 3 weeks later, and then the lawyer asks her a question and says, so it was several months later when you went to police, and she doesn't oppose that. She goes along with it. So that's it. That's all four witnesses. So all of the timeline stuff, everything that you've heard, I know I've yapped for over 50 minutes. Sorry. Didn't mean to do that. Let me try to tighten it up here for you guys just to give you a quick breakdown of everything. But I just wanted to make sure you have everything and you have the facts. So let's go through it one more time. Timestamps, we know. We know that at 12:25 p.m., Brianne Wilbur and Riley Voorhees and the two young girls were at the Freedom Bridge because they took a photo and it's timestamped. We know that at 2:43 p.m., that they were at the Monenheim Bridge because, again, they took a photo. It was timestamped. We know that at 1:26 p.m., they were returning back towards the Freedom Bridge. They stopped at a bench and took a photo at 1:26 p.m. We know because the photo is timestamped. And we know that after that, between that bench and the Freedom Bridge, that group encountered who they believe to be Bridge Guy. So sometime after 1:26 p.m., I think we can throw out the 2:15 time because it's just an estimate. Sometime after 1:26 p.m., they see Bridge Guy walking towards the Monenheim Bridge. Then we know that the girls got the trail at 1:49 p.m. We know Betsy Blair got to the trail at 1:45 p.m. So she actually got to the trail about 5 minutes before the girls did. She walks the loop, gets all the way to the Monenheim Bridge, sees a man standing out on one of the platforms. That would be, based on her Fitbit, somewhere right around 2:00. She turns around, is walking back out of the park, and passes Abby and Libby walking towards the bridge. then we know that was somewhere around 2. We know that at 2.05 p.m., so 5 minutes after that, Abby and Libby made it to the bridge and then continue. We didn't talk about this, but, you know, 2 minutes after that, Libby posts the Snapchat photo of Abby walking across the bridge. And then at 2.14 p.m. is when she takes the video. So by at 2.14 p.m., they have definitely encountered Bridge Guy. So within, you know, 14 minutes-ish, 15 minutes or so from the time Betsy Blair, we know, was at the bridge and saw the guy standing on the platform, within 15 minutes of that, the girls are on the other side of the bridge taking the video where we see Bridge Guy. So the only kind of analysis I give you on that is the person Betsy Blair saw very likely is the person who murdered Abby and Libby. I don't see really any way around that based on everything we know in the case so far. So that's timing stuff. And then of course, the only other timestamp we have is, you know, hour and 45 minutes, hour and 40 minutes later, 3:56 p.m., Sarah Carbaugh says she saw the man walking down the road muddy and or bloody. Things that will point out. So, you know, that's when they saw Bridge Guy. Then as far as how those statements line up with was Bridge Guy, because that's the big question, was Bridge Guy Richard Allen? That's what we need to know. So I go back to how they were described. First witness, again, Voorhees, she is 5 foot. I should point this out. Richard Allen is 5 foot four. He's quite short. He is 5 foot four. Voorhees is 5 foot seven. So she is, for a fact, 3 inches taller than Richard Allen. She said that the man was taller than her. She estimated to be about 5 foot 10, the man that they passed and had the encounter with. When we jump down to Breanne Wilbur, she says, and they all described, and they both described him as like big, possibly muscular, but definitely big. Breanne Wilbur said that she came up to approximately the upper arm of the man as they walked by. So he was a lot taller than her. She's saying that the top of her head only came up to his upper arm when they walked by. So you weigh that however you want. Now, so that's, I would say, the argument for innocence. Betsy Blair, who saw the man standing on the bridge, she just said her best guess was average height and he did not seem short. But that's 50 feet away, passing glance. It's hard to put much weight into that. The other two walked right past him and had markers like how tall they are and where they came up onto him. So those are definitely things that people would consider in the innocence camp. Well, if he's 5 foot four, she's 5'7", and she said he was taller than her, doesn't sound like Richard Allen. And if the other girl says, I only came up to his arm, he was, you know, more than a head taller than me, a head and a half taller than me, again, doesn't sound like Richard Allen. So there's that piece of it. The other piece of it is that leans more on the guilty side of it is Richard Allen. What we know from his statements is that he was at the bridge that day or on the trails, that he walked out to the Monon High Bridge and he stood out on a platform. So that lines up very, very well, you know, and that's the thing is Betsy Blair's statement is the one that appears to be most likely that she saw the killer. Again, just, that's simply based on timing. You know, at 2 o'clock, she sees a man standing on the platform that matches Bridge Guy's description. She turns around, walks down the trail, passes Abby and Libby walking towards the trail. 5 minutes later, Abby and Libby are at the trail. And 2 minutes after that, taking a picture on the bridge. 6 minutes after that, they're taking the video of Bridge Guy approaching them. And we know from the video that Bridge Guy took them down the hill. The person Betsy Blair saw, in all likelihood, was in fact Bridge Guy, the murderer. And again, the question is that you've got the way out is, do you believe Bridge Guy is Richard Allen? I think that if you go by Voorhees and Wilbur's statement, if you believe that's the same person that Betsy Blair saw, then that would lean no, I think. If you believe they could have seen someone different or were just completely wrong about the height, then that opens that door. The big thing is, and that's why, you know, there's a question in Richard Allen's statements, was he there at 12:30 or was he there at 1:30? Could he have been there at 1:30 went out to the bridge, stood on the platform, and walked back, working around all of this. Based on what I've been able to ascertain by how long it takes to make that walk and everything, yeah, it's possible. He could have gotten there at 1:30. He could have walked down the trail. It could have been, you know, he, after the group of four walked, you know, left the trail, he got to the trail, walked down, was at the bridge by 1:45, stood there for 10 minutes, left. Then Betsy Blair gets the trail and someone else is standing there then. I mean, that's all the things you have to wrestle with. And I'm not here to give you the answer to it. I'm just trying to give you context for how you can determine where you're at. Also give context for if you are on one side or the other and you think that the other side is just completely off their rocker and there's just nothing there to support their theory and they're just being biased assholes, I hope that this discussion, just based on these witnesses, makes you realize there are strong arguments in both directions here. Because then there's also the possibility that Richard Allen was telling the truth or was remembering accurately when he said, no, I got to the trail at 12:30, in which case he would have came and went before any of this happened. So that's it. I'm going to stop yapping. I'm over an hour in what was supposed to be the first act of this episode. At least I know myself well enough to know that there's no way I'd have been able to do that. So that's part one, the timeline. So next week, we're going to get into the firearms evidence. We're going to go over Melissa Oberg's testimony, not just what people are saying they heard or thought or different people's analysis. I'm looking right at the trial transcripts. I'm going to give you exactly what was said at trial. And if I can shut my mouth a little bit, I'm hoping to get through that and the confessions, focusing specifically on Dr. Walla, separating fact from fiction with her too. We've heard kind of, you know, very different viewpoints on Dr. Walla from the two different sides. I'm going to break down exactly what was said at the trial. And then after that, I'm going to get into the voice comparison, height from the video, you know, as far as who analyzed it. Because, you know, everybody's got a, you know, the voice analysis, you know, people are sure that they heard this voice. People are sure they know how tall Bridge Guy is. I'm going to give you exactly what we have from trial as far as what the experts said about that stuff, including what the officers say that they heard in Libby's video. You know, we're talking about like the gun racking, the that be a gun, all that stuff. So just kind of some hodgepodge things just to make sure that we have all of the facts. So that'll either all be next week or broken up into two more weeks. And that's it. We'll talk to you guys all about this on the follow-up this week. Bye, guys. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch.
But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.